Just a couple, again, a couple preliminary notes about the first and third readings. I love this obscure passage from the book of Nehemiah. In the history of the Jews, after they built the temple, they lost the book of the laws. Sort of like Father Sylvester's police report. It got stuck in the back of a cabinet, and nobody found it for a long time. And all of a sudden, they found it. And so what tickles me is the fact that the Jews were able to survive very nicely for a long, long time without their foundational documents, the rules. You know. Interesting, I think. Just about the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, this elegant, elegant language. Theophilus just means God lover, so whether Luke was writing to some person or just a kind of abstract audience. And what's important to note that this was a standard formal introduction to a piece of Roman literature. You explain what you're going to do in very elegant language, and it doesn't mean he was a historian in the strict sense of the word. He's just going to kind of organize a whole bunch of ideas when he talks about an orderly account. What's the significance of that? Well, first of all, the gospel could only have been addressed to a fairly sophisticated Roman audience. How many people were literate in the first century in the Roman Empire? Probably not too many. And those who were would have been wealthy, of course. They could afford to go to school. Which makes the whole thing fascinating because Luke is the gospel that insists most emphatically over and over again on the centrality of poverty in the following of Jesus. Okay. And next week we're going to get more from that, of course. But what I'd like to concentrate on is this passage from the letter to the Corinthians, which is for sure one of Paul's own letters. When I was teaching full-time at King's, it was a privilege, too, of introducing a course on the letters of Paul. And so I got to spend all kinds of time in the company of this quite astonishing man, as well as a bunch of his commentators, who were also very astonishing in their own way, and I became more and more not just immersed in it, but impressed by Paul. Paul's considered the first and in some ways the greatest of the theologians of the early Christian Jesus movement. And scholars were regularly at pains to try to figure what really was the central thing that just got this guy going. What is the central issue in Pauline theology? And it's not just an idle question, because if you can do that, then you can attach everything from all seven of the authentic letters to what he said. And there were several proposals. Probably the most famous of one, because of Martin Luther, is the notion of salvation not by works, but by faith and by grace. But it's important to remember that when Luther was trying to reform the church, not build a new one, but simply reform it, there were all these extra things. You know, you pay money and you get indulgences, and then you release all your relatives from purgatory, and you're obedient, and you worship, and you have relics of saints, and you had all these religious practices which are supposed to make you holy. Luther said, "Fooey on that stuff, folks. The central thing is simply the grace of God." And that's, of course, what came to be the Protestant Reformation was based upon. And we actually know that that's legitimate Catholic theology, except we had lost sight of it under this great weight of practices and observances and all that other stuff. That it's only grace that saves us. And then some people say, no, it's Paul's idea of freedom. And you can make an argument for that. Or it was the centrality of the cross. Paul constantly talks about, I am with Christ, I am nailed to the cross of the world. I preach Christ and him crucified. And you get all these texts which seem to say that Paul is fixated on the centrality of the cross in the living of the following of Jesus. But I spent enough time to come up with a fourth idea, the Trojan. This is the Trojan hypothesis about what hold Paul together. And I think I can make a good case for it. What made Paul turn from being a Pharisaic Jew to a Jesus Jew? The Pharisees were the most intensely observant of the Jews, and the word Pharisee itself, the Hebrew, seems to mean separate. So they didn't want pagans or lackluster or half-hearted Jews into the thing. They just wanted the real thing. And so they had the 613 precepts of the law, and everybody had to be careful about that and all this business. And that was really what Paul was very much engaged in. And then he gets a sense that all that stuff doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. And above all, the distinctions that it made between the followers of Jesus, the Jesus Jews and the non-Jesus Jews, and the pagans even, all that stuff collapsed in the light of who Jesus was and how he operated. In other words, community that is now constituted by the following of Jesus, and a universal community, is what Paul was really interested in, more than the cross or grace or freedom. And all those things find their place, of course, but only within the largest context, that we are all, as he will say in one audacious line, we are members of each other. And so in this passage from the Corinthians, which also, of course, contains a great hymn of love, love is patient, love is kind, blah, 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 blah. He takes, because Paul was bicultural, he was a Roman citizen as well as a Jew, he took a standard political metaphor, namely, as the political reality was seen in analogy to the human body, where all the parts fit together, which is just exactly what Paddy was reading. Yeah. And that's one way of saying that we are all, even the most alien-seeming members, belong to each other and with each other. I think that this, if we were to take this stuff seriously, this would really have transformative power. To believe, in other words, that each of us is inadequate, deficient, insufficient without everybody else. That our own completion depends on our relating to everybody else as essential parts of our own selfhood. This is so countercultural, especially for us in North America, that it's even hard to, I think, get your head around. I'm teaching, again, a couple courses, and sure enough, the first night, there's this bright, intense-looking young man in the first row. In the middle of the class, you're trottling on two things. He said, what do I have to do to get a 90 in this course? That was his question. He didn't show up again the second week. But it struck me that the course or other members in the course or even the material of the course were insignificant. Rather than, can he beat out anybody else to be on the top of the heap? I mean, the university is a ferociously competitive environment. Everybody is a real or possible threat to my advancing through the ranks. Certainly in the faculty, that's true. But among students as well. Now, if that's the case, how do you come to believe that all those others out there are, to Paul's words, really a part of me. And I am a part of them. And I need them in order to be fully myself. And I am fully myself only when I am with them. See, everything militates against that, I think. I mean, self-consciousness, the very act of self-consciousness, seems to be a divisive, separating thing. I live inside my own head. I don't live inside anybody else's head, and I can't live inside anybody else's head. And of course, we have validated, certified, legitimated that kind of individualism in every conceivable way in North America. Okay. That's just the way it is. Competition is the law of life for us. And it is very, very hard, I think, in the light of all that, with all the centrifugal forces at work, politically, in the church, in family, how do we get beyond that? I think that the utility of Paul and the utility of this reading from 1 Corinthians is to at least bring up the possibility as something that should be seriously entertained. And it'll stand as judgment, certainly for me, on this radical individualism, which is part and parcel of who I am. To begin to look at everybody and say, man, we're all connected. Some of you may know Thomas Merton's writings, and in one astonishing passage, when he got out of the monastery to go to see a doctor in Memphis, I forget where the Gethsemane was. And he talked about standing on the corner of Oak and Main Street and looking around and just being overwhelmed by the fact that all these strangers and he were one. And his heart just kind of exploded with this universal embrace of all these people whom he didn't know. I bring that up because that's an instance, I think, of what apparently was driving Paul as well. The pagans, all his Pharisaic past, needed to be dismantled. And of course, he's not unique in the New Testament, because if you read that other great theologian of the New Testament, or theologians, because there are probably a bunch of them, the people who wrote the Gospel of John and the letters. Remember, that's where we find all this stuff, that we're supposed to be one with each other as Jesus is with the Father. It's the same thing. It's utter, radical, transformative intimacy. I don't know where we go with this, frankly, except for me, it is. I need to hear this. I need to be told this again, because it stands as a thoroughgoing criticism of my standard way of looking at the world, my experience of the world, the way I treat other people. And it's not just a question of being nice or being kind. That's not it at all. It's a question of an essential interrelatedness, a necessary interrelatedness, of which I've had glimpses maybe a few times in my life. But that's what Paul can do for us now, I think, to help us, remind us again and again, that's where we belong. Not in this nice, safe, tidy enclave, which is myself.